Welcome to another episode of Sermon Podcast Hour with the Collective Table. It's Claire, and today I'm joining Chelsea as we sit down to chat with Joe Kim.
Reverend Joe Kim serves as lead pastor of Bothell United Methodist Church. Before entering parish ministry, Joe was the director of children's rights advocacy at the General Board of Church and Society of the United Methodist Church in Washington, D.C. Here he focused on policy and advocacy efforts to combat human trafficking and promote equal education opportunities for all children. He has also served as Director for Community Care at Spark 12, Senior Associate for Membership Development and Services for the Conference of Non-Governmental Organizations and Relationship with the United Nations, and Program and Administrative Assistant at the General Board of Church and Society of the United Methodist Church. Joe has traveled around the world as a speaker and workshop leader and facilitator, encouraging people of faith to do justice, to love kindness, and to walk humbly with God.
We're so glad you're joining us for this dynamic, inspirational, and important conversation. If you like what you hear, be sure to share it with a friend, give us a like, or even give us a rating. You can also find The Collective Table on Instagram, Facebook, and our website at thecollectivetable.org.
To start our conversation, we wanted to give you a taste of Pastor Joe's sermon with this longer clip. If you'd like to listen to his full sermon, check out the show notes or our website. This is a particularly meaningful conversation for me, as Joe and I have been good friends for over 5 years. We met in seminary and were immediately friends. Joe is a passionate speaker, an advocate for social justice, and a deep biblical thinker. This sermon was preached during Lent as part of a larger sermon series called The Bigger Picture. Entitled I Am the Resurrection and the Life, this sermon focuses on the scripture found in John 11, in which Lazarus dies and Jesus reminds his sisters that not only is he offering life after death, but also here and now. We hope you enjoy it. Hi, everyone. We are so excited for you to join us for another episode of the Sermon Podcast Hour. Today is a special day for me because I get to invite and welcome my good friend, Reverend Joseph Kim, to the podcast. Joe, how long have we been friends for?
Oh, my goodness. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I'm so excited for this conversation ahead. I think we've known each other for 5 years now, meeting at General Conference when we were both seminarians over in Portland.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh. And since then, we've been in covenant groups and shared sermons and thoughts and ideas. So whenever we were putting this podcast season together, I knew I wanted you to be a part of it. You just have such a powerful way of preaching the good news, of bringing in what's happening in the world. Your passion is evident. And so I'm just so excited to lift up this sermon in particular, but for people to kind of know that you are out in the world doing this good work. So we're excited to dive in on this one. So why don't we just start to kind of like contextualize it? So who are you preaching this to? When was it?
yeah, like give us a little bit of around, well, where, how should we be listening to this?
Yeah, so I have the privilege of serving Bothell United Methodist Church. It's a church in the northern suburbs of Seattle. I serve as a lead pastor there. And this sermon came during Lent of 2021, so earlier this year. And we were still in the midst of COVID and the pandemic. We were still all online at the time. And so we are exploring different ways to connect with the story of Jesus and how we might continue to be disciples while we are not gathered and not able to be physically together. What we ended up doing was what we were trying to figure out, how do we best connect not only our church locally, but the partner churches around us. And so working with another church in our area, we came up with this idea of the bigger picture, looking at the I am statements of Jesus. Right. And looking at how all of these pieced together create a more fuller image of who Jesus is and how we took each of those week to week. And so this one was in the middle of the series. We hit on John 11, I am the resurrection and the life. And that's kind of where we were.
Nice. Nice. I have so many questions for you. I'm not quite sure where to start. But for our listeners, if you go and watch Joe's sermon on YouTube, there's one thing you might notice right up front. He's not wearing any shoes. So Joe, I would love to hear about this. I'm sure there's an awesome, insightful reason.
Yeah. So, you know, part of my story, I got to serve and got my ministry start in Harlem, New York. I was serving at a church called Salem United Methodist Church in Harlem. And along my journey, I got a call to come out to Seattle, suburban, majority white, middle upper class church here in Bothell. And the style and the flow and the rhythm was so completely different, right? Preaching in New York and Harlem in Black church, there was a lot of energy and dynamics. There's a lot of talk back. And you could, I felt like I could sense a rhythm and I could feel the energy. Whereas here, when I started preaching, and there's a lot more dynamics to that, too. I here in Bothell, everything was online. And there's another layer of messing with your psyche and trying to, you know, figure out how to best portray all that. But I was having trouble connecting with the energy of the sermon time. There wasn't a lot of response. There wasn't a lot of verbal cues. People laughed at the right places, right? You know, but it was hard to find those, to feel it. And one day I was in the middle of our 10:30 service, before COVID times. And, I had, in my mind, I had bombed the 8 o'clock and the 9 o'clock. They're fine. Good news was proclaimed and all that good stuff, but it just, I wasn't feeling it. And I was praying and I kept hearing in my mind or repeating this phrase, you know, God's rhythm, not mine, right? God's rhythm. And as much as I try to force my own rhythm into or my own energy into my preaching, unless I'm in tune with God's rhythm, then I'm missing it. And so I felt this call to take my shoes off. And I was so embarrassed that I didn't do it that Sunday. And I went home and I talked to my spouse, Joanne, and I was like, I wanted to take my shoes off and I didn't. She goes, why didn't you? And I was like, I don't know. Like, I was ashamed and I didn't know what that would be like. And these are white folk who they're not used to like dynamic preaching and energy and flow and stomping around. And so the next week I just made a commitment. I was like, you know what? If I feel it again, I'm going to take my shoes off. And I prayed and I prayed before the 8 o'clock, which was our contemplative service. And it's more low energy anyway. I was like, oh, surely I can keep my shoes on for this. And I felt God just saying, no, this is holy ground too. So take your shoes off and approach. And so I'm drawing from Exodus 3, right, where Moses approaches the bush. But now whenever I proclaim or whenever I preach, it's a constant reminder for me to remember that this is holy. This isn't about my sermon. It's God's sermon, right, that's coming through. And if I try to make it so much about myself, I'm going to lose that connection with God. So taking my shoes off allows me to feel the ground and be a tangible way of reminding that grounding and that rhythm. Yeah.
Mm, that's so cool. So what has the response been like from the congregation? Because I've preached with my shoes off before and I did not get the best.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been a, no one has said put your shoes back on. So I'm grateful for that. when we were when I preached from the pulpit, I can sometimes see people taking pictures, and I look for it online later of like, oh, what socks is Pastor Joe wearing today, or what? Sometimes and so now it's become this, you know, ongoing thing. In college football, University of Washington played University of Michigan, which is my alma mater, recently this fall. And when the University of Michigan won, I wore my Michigan socks, right? And so the people here in Washington got to see. And so it's a way also to kind of have that subtle connection with our people. They've gotten used to it. Just a couple weeks ago, our camera didn't move fast enough. And so I was walking across the platform to the stand where I would be preaching, and it followed my socks, and I couldn't not talk about it. So I had to say, hey, these are my Tachosaurus socks. It's dinosaurs with a taco shell as the spine, and just kind of, you know, made light of it and moved on.
You can tell Reverend Joe's mood by the socks he's wearing.
That's right. That's right. That's right. But now I have to get nice socks, right? Like, it can't be plain anymore. So
you got to make sure they match. You got to make sure there's no hole. I mean, there's now comes another level.
That's right. That's right.
No, but I love that because it is holy ground. I mean, we're always on holy ground, but there's something particular about preaching a sermon that what you're saying, Joe, you know, you're the vessel of God's grace and mercy, and you're trying to be unhindered. Like, there's nothing that you want to get in the way of that unhindered. So, I think that's a very intentional way of grounding in that. So I think that's actually really beautiful.
Yeah. And how often pastors and preachers get in our own way, right? Like, I think it's really easy to make a sermon about myself. Like, I worked hard on this. I'm confident in the message, and it becomes about me, right? Like, and how not only my community or my congregation, but how the world sees me. And if that's my driving a reason of preaching, then I'm completely missing the point of why God has called me to proclaim and what impact that we can have with the communities we serve.
That's beautiful. I think that fits really beautifully in with the entire sermon series that this sermon fit within, because you talk about this puzzle that all of our individual relationships with Jesus, and you talk about Mary and Martha's relationship with Jesus, fit into this beautiful picture of who Jesus is. But as I was listening, I was thinking about how hard it is to fit those pieces together. And I was wondering if you would talk to us more about like the challenges of these puzzle pieces making up this picture of Jesus.
Right. I mean, it's we don't have the benefit of having those pre-cut stenciled out, you know, pieces that fit. Right. And so I think it's messy. And I think because we bring so much of our own experiences, and as Methodists, right, bringing together the ways that we do apply historical tradition and science and reason and our personal experiences to the ways that we see not only Jesus, but the way that we see God's story in throughout history or throughout time, I think it gets messy when we are expected to and encouraged to do life in community. Like, I can have my image of Jesus and be good, right? Like, all my pieces fit. But when I'm talking to you and when I'm having these conversations with my church folk and with my community, that's where it gets messy of how do we, with our own understanding of who Jesus is, now make up the collective community of who Jesus is to us and to the world. And I think that's the hard part about why we do faith and why we allow for those conversations to happen. You know, we don't say, here's the right answer. You got to believe what we believe. But this ongoing dialogue and wrestling of here's one way that we might experience Jesus. And it might be at a certain time, you know, when my grandmother died, I needed Jesus to be comforting Jesus, right? When you see injustice in the world, I need Jesus to be the one who cries out and declares that there will be justice, you know? And I think we have these times and moments and opportunities in our lives to engage Jesus in a different way. And I think that's the beauty of it, that Jesus isn't pigeonholed, and yet we can come to it on our own and in community.
And there's something about like staying humble, knowing that other people can teach us about Jesus that we, you know, didn't know before or didn't consider before, that we haven't got Jesus and God all figured out, that we can kind of, we don't have to agree with everybody, but that we can stay open to other people's puzzle pieces. And like, that's how we can fit together too.
Yeah, and so much of conflict, I think, in our world and our communities is because we claim to have an ownership of Jesus, or claim to have an ownership of the right faith, or the correct way of believing, or those absolutes. And I think if we can approach with more vulnerable spirits of saying, I'm here to learn and to understand that your experience is different than mine, and yet Jesus is big enough for all of that. Which, you know, goes back to that kind of our theme, bigger picture, right? Like, is that there is a bigger Jesus than the one that I claim for myself, who, which is true and authentic and real to me, but not the whole, right? And so I think that's where we really try to draw upon this bigger picture idea of who Jesus is.
And you talk about the mosaic. It's like we're each this little picture. And I do think we last season we were talking about what God looks like. Like we are what we are collectively what God looks like. And like you said in the sermon, when the one piece of the puzzle is missing, the puzzle isn't complete. Like we need everybody to make up the full picture of who Jesus is, you know? So
yeah,
I appreciated absolutely. That. Yeah.
And recognizing that as a preacher yourself, you know, by saying it's not about me, you know, it's about the entire picture. Because I think so often, I mean, we as preachers and pastors or even lay people have this idea that we have all the answers, and that's not the case. The beauty of being in ministry is getting to come alongside of people in that. Like we might have some extra head knowledge that might help, but that doesn't mean it's the definite answer.
Absolutely. And just thinking about our own context, right? Like we can't, it's not only that we don't, like to me, like, there's something fundamental about not only do I not have your experience, I can't. And I want to honor your experiences of the complete fullness of who you are. And in order to do that, then it's who you experience Jesus to be allows for that, you know, holy conversation to happen between us as individuals and in the broader community as we try to go closer to this, you know, living in community together.
We dove into the sermon because we have so many questions, but you do something really beautiful at the before your sermon. And this is the time where Asian Americans were just were murdered at the spas in Atlanta. And you light a candle for each of the victims. You know, being Asian American yourself, I wonder if you could just talk to us about how that tragedy affected you. How did it influence your sermon? How maybe any difficulties or challenges you had in kind of being bridging those two things? I mean, you can tell you're emotional in that moment, and rightfully so. And so I just wonder if you could share with us about that.
Yeah. So, as I mentioned, the sermon was happening during the pandemic period where we weren't in person. So we changed our order of worship. We went from three services to one, and we had to change our order of worship to make sense for the community. And when we were meeting exclusively in person, we had multiple opportunities for us to welcome the community. So we would welcome them up front. There would be a lady welcome, and then we would preach much later. But we found that there was too much back and forth by trying to maintain that same order of worship in an online presence. And so we actually, this is a combination of doing the pastoral welcome, and tying it directly to the sermon to go into it one another. And so usually I would do something in the sermon, in the welcome time that invites folks to recognize that, hey, you are welcome, you belong. And we go through a litany of folks who that includes. You're welcome if you're gay, lesbian, transgender, bisexual, or questioning. You're welcome if you're Black or brown or Indigenous, or if you've been discriminated against because of the color of your skin. Or we recognize marital status, like divorced folk are often ostracized in churches, right? Low-income folk or homeless or houseless folks, people with differing gifts and abilities. So we go through this whole process every Sunday to declare that for this next little while, you're welcome and you belong. But as we were in this pandemic, we put them together with the sermon time, and which was really hard, actually, because I usually disconnect the two. I want that welcome period to be specifically about that welcome moment, and then we're going to go into the word. And as we had to put them together with the tragedy that happened that week, I couldn't separate what God was speaking to our community and to our world from the incidents that were happening around us. And this isn't the first, right? You know, since COVID, the Chinese flu or the Kung flu, or right, like you we hear how Asian folk have been attacked, and you know, in previous sermons I talk about, actually, I have friends who share about, you know, their parents being literally knocked down in the street while they're carrying groceries, or cars being keyed, and so as an Asian American serving in a predominantly white context, and the nuances of the model minority, the nuances of the silent minority as an Asian American, the expectations that we are meek and we didn't speak out, it was putting all of those together in a way that I couldn't not talk about it. But I also didn't know how to talk about it. And so you'll notice in that beginning part, I just named, like, hey, this stuff happened. It sucks. It's not okay. And we're going to light candles because in the midst of all this, I got nothing to say about it right now. Right. And so we honor their lives. We said their names. We didn't want to get lost. And as I was preparing for this, so that happened first, right? I prepared that and I was like, we got to do that. We got to do the candles. And then as I was preparing for the sermon and doing the work around what does it mean for Jesus to say, I am the resurrection and the life? And how we as Christians are so traditionally have gone through, like we were talking about earlier, there's a clear way of believing that's going to get you to heaven. And if that's the goal, then I think we're missing the point of why we're doing life. Right? We might as well not do life, because if all we're trying to do is get to heaven, then these 80, 90 for many of us and whatever, this period of time of life doesn't make any sense and doesn't matter if the point is to get to heaven. And so that really shaped the way that I looked at the scripture text to allow for what was happening in the world, especially with these Asian American women, and especially with a hyper-sexualized culture, right? The purity culture that came out of the 90s, right? Of why this guy who went on this killing spree, who decided that he would be the one to get rid of these temptations, that had to have come from the church, I think. Right? This purity culture. And so what impact are we having as people of faith? And what are we teaching as pastors and as leaders of churches for our people to say, hey, you can come on Sunday and hear this 1 hour message, but for the rest of the week, you'll go do whatever you want to do.
You talk about Robert Long, this murderer, and the way that the church and purity culture played a role, possibly or definitely, in this murder. And as Chelsea and I were talking about this, we were wondering, like,
What are specific ways we can be better as the church? I think you've definitely touched on talking about it is one way. But sometimes, you know, I feel so at a loss for words.
Yeah, and I think you hit it earlier, Claire, talking about humility, right? Like, I think if we can get out of our own way and stop claiming God to be ours alone and in the image of our image, right? It opens up so much of the potential of who God's calling us to be. Because if God is calling us to be this one way, and in the case of Robert Long and frankly, white nationalists, right, and white Christian nationalists in today's context, God wants us to be American and all of these other things, right? And if that's our own definition of who God is, then where is there room in that God for me, Asian American male? Where is there room in that God for my queer sibling? Where is there room in that God for and on and on and on, right? And so I think as pastors, we've done the work of study and research and being intentional about sitting with texts and listening to God, but if we get in the way of that and say that this is my interpretation of that and that's the only way, then we're creating a whole new generation that's only going to be thinking about God out of fear, out of fear of damnation, right? Out of fear of exclusion, being excluded from community. And so, you know, yes, be humble, talk about it. And then I think, you know, for those of us who are in that space, to speak out against it, right? Like, sorry, that's not my God.
Right. I was going to say, like, and the church has to claim responsibility, repent, and lament the role that we have had in perpetuating white, straight, cisgender men that are American. You know what I mean? I mean, like, the church has had a pivotal role in society and the church and people's individual lives. And, you know, I think we have to, what we're kind of all saying is really name that, but really say that was wrong. Like, that is not the God that we serve, believe, you know, I mean, we have to be, but also claiming our responsibility. I mean, in the case of Robert Long, that's our fault. You know, I mean, like, that, there's a part of that that is on us to repent for.
Yeah, there's just the other week I was preaching about remembering our stories. I read this, the book Caste, The Caste System by Wilkerson. And it's a beautiful book. And she talks about how she visited Germany. And in Germany, there's a constant reminder and remembrance of the Holocaust and the horror that was and continues to be reminded and fueled. And she was telling the story of one of the tour guides who leads these children and leads them in facilitating conversation and says, hey, your German kids, do you take responsibility for this? And they go into their small groups and then they talk and then they have these debates and then they come back and they share. And the tour guide told the story of how this one kid said, no, like, we don't take responsibility of the actions. That belongs to the generations that allowed for that horror to happen. But we take responsibility for making sure that doesn't happen again. And this kid, the 7-year-old kid, right? Early elementary school kid. And I think that's us, right? Like, not to name that there isn't harm still being done. Absolutely there is. I'd like to think that we're on the right track and we can only take that next step further if we make that commitment to not allow our kids' generations. You know, I have a 6- and a 3-year-old. Chelsea, I know you have young kids as well. Like, how will they understand the Jesus in their life? And are we going to be the ones to allow for them to have the curiosity and the questioning to maybe believe a Jesus that's different than mine and still be in that holy community together, right?
It's such a heavy task. I'm the youth and children's pastor at our church. And I mean, obviously ministering to adults is just as important, but I almost take it even more seriously with children and youth just because it's so important. And that's such a tender time while they're developing and filling out their picture of God. So everything that we say at church is going somewhere.
Yeah, and that's where we were formed too, right? Like, I mean, I grew up in the 90s. The youth movement was huge, right? Like, all the youth, the music, Christian music groups, and the trucker hats, and the bracelets, and, you know, all of the movement was real, and how influenced I was, and the generation that I grew up with, how we were. Now, we're perpetuating it with, you know, continuing purity culture, continuing, you know, the white nationalist almost embodiment of who Jesus is, and how can we push against that? Are we willing to push against that, right? And I think, you know, the task that we have as church leaders and those who are shaping folks' own theologies is to burst down any idea that there is a right answer.
I often wonder, like, when I think about, this is where we go back to the puzzle piece, right? Like,
yeah,
I'm part of the puzzle piece, and so is the white nationalist Christian who thinks, you know what I mean? And like, I struggle so often with like, and yet we're a part of the same picture. And if that person's not there, the picture of Jesus is not complete also. And that's so hard. Like, and Jesus never told us it would be easy. But I struggle with that because, you know, that's where the difficulty of like, do we really fit together? Like, you know, and it's, I don't know, just when you were saying that, it's like, and we have to all, you know, share and the responsibility of being Christ on earth, right? Or God on earth.
Yeah. I think there's a difference and it requires a boldness to be able to say, while I may not know the right way, I know that that way is not right. Right. And I think there's that both and, the tension of I need to be open and vulnerable enough to know that the image of Jesus that I've made for myself is not complete. But I also need to have the courage and the boldness to be able to say, meanwhile, yours is just not right. There's scripturally and throughout time and the way that we, I think, experience God in the movement of God's Spirit today, the image of Jesus cannot include those who would kill for the sake of life everlasting, right? It's just a complete, they don't align.
But you know what? I guess my thought in it is like, I've been struggling with that because what do you do then with the person that, and to separate the person from the belief and like the person is included in the puzzle, whereas that, you know, bigotry, racism, misogyny is not included, you know what I mean? And like the difficult work of separating belief from person, especially when in this time, it feels like you are your belief. It almost feels like you are your belief or they are their belief. And so it's like the difficult work of loving the person that holds all of the different beliefs of you, you know, about such important things as like what Jesus looks like and what Jesus would do and how Jesus would vote and like just being, you know, holding those two things in that tension.
And like keeping in mind, just like you said, Chelsea, that like beliefs can and should change and shift. Like I think we had another conversation with someone else this season. We talked about, you know, things that we may have done a few years ago that we're like, wow, I can't believe we did that. And recognizing that there might be things that we believe or do now that we might look back on and having the humility to say like that was wrong and giving the benefit of the doubt to other people in that way. Not as an excuse, but as an act of humility.
Yeah, and I think that's the key is Jesus' story or God's story is unfolding and ongoing, right? And I think that those who claim to know the truth about Jesus, and I just did air quotes that our folks aren't going to be able to see, but this the people who claim to know that truth can't imagine an ongoing of the story because there's an absolute beginning and an end. The truth is here, right? Whereas I think as we experience our story shape and should constantly be shaping how we understand not only God, but ourselves in God's story, because we're also not the same people we were 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 15, last week. The experiences I've had in this past week have already shaped who I experience God to be as I prepare for this week's sermon, right? And I think that there's this constant ongoing and the conversation happening. So when we think about folks who say there's an absolute truth to who Jesus is, and it's in my image, there's a very, it's very finite and it's limited, right? But if we can open up that person to understand and be willing to experience the fullness of their story, then it doesn't limit God, and it doesn't limit God's work in that person's life. It frees us to have these conversations. I think that's where we can allow for that. Hey, your belief right now, I don't think is right. I can't be right based on this, this, and this. But how did you get there? And how will you get beyond that?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It's like, it's meeting them where they're at with compassion, knowing that their life experience has led them to that particular belief for a plethora of different reasons, right? And it's having the compassion to say, like, tell me about that. Like, how did you get there? And understanding their story. There's so much in this sermon, and you preached this sermon during Lent, all of these I am statements, and Lent is, you know, the 40 days leading up to Easter, not including Sundays, that we are preparing for the arrest, execution, and resurrection of Jesus. And you talk about, you say, this tension starts to reach its boiling point in the end where when the religious leaders make it clear that they are willing to kill Jesus because their way had to be the right way. Which talks about like what we're talking about now. And I think religious leaders in some have that same thing. How do you see that show up in the world today, that same truth? I think often we think this was back then, but really just manifesting itself differently.
Yeah.
Maybe the same now.
Well, yeah, maybe the same, just looks different. But I think, what I love about John, this gospel according to John, it starts with these two signs, right? It starts with a sign in the beginning where he's at a wedding, this celebratory event where he reveals himself when his time is not yet, he says, right? It's my time is not yet. And still he takes water, makes it wine. It's the best wine, finest wine, abundance and celebration. And here's what is to come. And then as he's performing these signs, he threatens the institution that exists because there have been already established rules of operation. There's a clear hierarchy. The people in power want to stay in power. And often religion is what allows for that to happen. And it was the case then and it is now, right? And so when we're looking at the fullness of Jesus' life as depicted in this gospel, we see him performing these signs, which are all invitations, right? He performs these signs as invitations to come and follow. See these signs, see these miracles. They're ways for you to engage and be invited into the fullness of this new community. And that freaks the institution out because they're taking people away. They're taking power away, they're taking resources away, and therefore redirecting it against the institution and towards the people. And so at the end, right, we're now in John 11, and John 10 ends with Jesus saying, I came to give you life and life abundant, and then the folks are like, whoa, 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 like you get life through me, because I'm power, I'm institution, I dictate whether you are going to live or die, I dictate whether you are going to have or have not. Right. And so when Jesus starts to really push the boundaries, the institution, these religious leaders, they come to this final sign, and it's appropriate that it's at the death and funeral of Lazarus. Right. So we start with this wedding, the celebration, this new life together. And we end with this funeral, this death. And in that moment, you know, as we're navigating this, I think the leaders are saying, how do we prevent that from happening? And I think we see that, as you're saying, you know, all the time today, right? We think about the ways we vote, right? The ways that we vote and the ways that we use quote unquote Christianity to say, here's the right way to vote. In order to be Christian, you need to X, Y, and Z. And I think we can fill in those things, right? And so how do we keep power the way that we keep power and therefore lose the identity of Jesus for the sake of institution and for the sake of hierarchy? that prevents abundance, I think. And so, yeah, I think this is happening all the time in the ways that, and so even in ways that are ingrained and embedded in who we are, we can't help but live in a capitalist system where we think about life in scarcity model, right? We can't help but think about voting in terms of what gives me the best benefits or the most privileges. I can't help but think about how not to level the playing field and create equality and justice in society because I'm driven by my own sense of power, and therefore Jesus is not involved in that equation. I got preachy on you. Sorry about that. No,
that's good. Listen, when you're interviewing preachers,
yeah, I know, right?
The sermons slip in sometimes, you know, that's kind of the way of it.
We talked about this earlier. You so beautifully and appropriately wed what's happening in the world with what you're preaching. And I'm just wondering if this text were, if you were to preach on this text this Sunday, you know, in our current world, this was quite a bit ago. A lot has happened since then. How would it change, if at all? Or how would you preach this?
Yeah. I mean, I think the context of so much of how we preach, how I preach, is driven by what's happening in the world and what's happening in my community. Just the other day, there was a shooting in Boise, Idaho. Left two people dead. The gunman also died. But how do we look at this text of "I am death and resurrection. I am life, resurrection and the life," in light of gun violence? How do we look at this text in light of vaccine mandates or masks, wearing masks, right? How do I see the Jesus who allows for life to happen now as I think about the growing population of those who are dying from homelessness, especially as we enter winter? Right, and looking at a cold winter shelter. So I think if we're not driven by what's happening around us, I mean that's the focus of the sermon. It's let's not only be thinking about life everlasting, which we claim, and the future of who God is creating in the midst of the long arc of the world, and this, you know, eternal life that we will live into someday. Great. But if we're not directly navigating what's happening in our lives today and the things that are around us, we're failing to be church. And, you know, thinking about at the end, you know, I talk about Lazarus and Jesus eating together. Like, that's the embodiment of what we're trying to get to, right? Like, Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead and they hang out. They do life. They're in community. And when I look at, you know, my siblings, when I look at the people around me, when I look at hate and when I look at oppression, when I look at fear, that's not doing life together, right? And so I think that's how, you know, what is happening around us that we as people of faith can speak into. It's going to be different where y'all are in San Diego and where we're in Seattle. And yet this passage still speaks to how we as people of faith are called to live out our lives, right?
And I so appreciate you. You know, we do have hope in Jesus and afterlife, and like that's, but you know what you did? Something in the sermon that you said is like, Martha, when she goes out to meet Jesus, she says the right thing, right? Like, you know, Jesus, I know that my brother will be with you on the last day. And I wonder, and Jesus is saying, well, yes, but also now today. And I wonder how often we cling to these things that we have been taught or we think are the right answers, that really we're missing the abundance and expansive way that Jesus is really trying to show up for us now, because we are clinging to the, you know, the right thing. And I think that, like, you outlined that so perfectly in that part. It was just like, but Martha, you're, and I feel like that's the theme of Jesus's life. Like, people all around him are always not really grasping it right. But like, we hold on to our thing and we miss the better thing.
Yeah, and we miss Jesus, I think, alive today, right? So if we're looking at this text simply as words on a paper or words on pages, we see the gospel, according to John, of this description and narrative of Jesus' life as invitations to those specific people. Fine, right? That's a great story. That's good. And so every one of his signs and every time that he engages the people that he did, as recorded in the gospel, it is an invitation to them. But then we lose how that invitation is also to us. And so I think that that's where it is, right? If we want to limit Jesus's words at the time to Martha, then great. Focus on life everlasting. That's, you know, yes, Jesus says, I am the resurrection and the life. We apply that simply to the cross. We apply that to only how Jesus died, raised again in 3 days, and fine, all is well in the world. But if we claim a risen Jesus who is alive and at work through the Spirit in us today, you can't stop at resurrection. You can't stop with Jesus saying, I am the resurrection, because that's a one-time thing that happened. That's great. And yes, there's a promise of the future, but Jesus continues and says, I am the resurrection and the life. In other words, Joe, I'm inviting you into this community and this work and this partnership and this life now, and I'm inviting every single one to be part of that today, right?
Yeah, we say on earth as it is in heaven. We can't forget that on earth part.
Yeah.
But it is, you close the sermon, yeah, talking about this beautiful picture of Lazarus and Jesus eating together, and they're laughing and enjoying each other's company. And when I was listening to that, I was like, and Jesus wants to laugh and eat and have life with us now. And like, and we want to do that with one another. We just, doing this life together with Jesus is like this beautiful picture of what Christianity can be, right? Like life together for real. I remember, Joe, like a number of years ago, you were talking about, are you refrigerator friends? Do you remember that?
yeah.
like how many people are you, well, you explain it, it's your thing.
Yeah. So I can't remember who, I was at a conference and we're in this room of all these pastors, right? And all these church leaders. And this guy goes, look around and how many of you are friends with the people in this room? And they all, you know, we're all like, yeah, these are my friends. And he goes, how many of you have seen the inside of these people's fridges? And everyone's hands like went down. And he's like, in order for you to be a friend, you got to be able to be vulnerable enough that someone sees your beer and your spoiled yogurt and the leftovers that's been there for a week and the steak that you have prepared for on Friday when you have date night and the celebration cake. Like, you got to be able to see all of that together inside someone's fridge. But more than that, you got to be willing to open your own fridge for someone else to see. And so that moment of Jesus and Lazarus eating and laughing, and I mean, I imagine, you know, burping and having food stuck in their teeth and spilling and all of that together, that intimacy of saying, hey, we're going to sit next to each other on the floor in proximity with one another. That is, to me, the beautiful image of community. And we can't do that until we break down, right, those walls of saying, I'm going to get to heaven. You may or may not, but I'm going to get to heaven. Until we experience that life together today, you know, how do we continue to do this Christian life? It doesn't work in my mind if we're only focused on that long term.
Yeah. I would like to think that if I'm sitting and laughing with Jesus and had food stuck in my teeth, that he would tell me. He would be one of those friends that would say,
he's one of those friends. That's
something
right.
Stuck in your
yep. Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, I know, Joey, in your community, you've started dinner churches, and we've been doing dinner churches for a little bit, but there is something about sitting at a table with someone and this vulnerable experience of eating, you know, the things that can happen when you eat. You could spill, get stuff stuck in your teeth. But like when I think about traditional church, which is wonderful and beautiful, you can leave a pew sitting next to someone and never know their name. And you cannot sit across a table for someone and not know their, at least their name, right?
Right.
Or how much salt they use. Or, you know, I mean, like
And so
it's just like there's a difference between going to church and doing life together. And I think the fullness of what God wants for us is this life together, knowing what's in our fridges type of friendships. And so I just, you know, it's like we're missing the point. We're holding on to, I need to be at church every Sunday to hear the hour sermon. But we're missing the betterness that God has for us, which is this like intimate relationship.
Right. And it's remembering what the purpose of church is, right? Like if I'm going to church every Sunday in order to secure my place in heaven, like fine. Like, but I think that the reason we do church, the reason we make that commitment to go regularly, the reason we want to be with one another is to be refreshed and rejuvenated for the week ahead. Right. And so if your moment of holiness and sacredness with God stops after the 1 hour service on Sunday, then you're missing that whole life part. But hopefully, I'm being careful, I hope that the pastors and preachers are preaching a message that allows for you to take that into your week so that you can do life together, not so that you can get to heaven someday, right? Like, and I think that if we can reimagine the reasons why we do church, why we go to church, we talk about, at Bothell, we don't talk about Sunday morning as church, we talk about it as worship. Because there's a clear component to that 1 hour segment that we do together, but church is the rest of it, right? Because we're doing church through small group, through service in the community, through connecting in conversation, through et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so this moment of worship is also a part of that church, but it drives us beyond the, I'm going to go to church, sit here for an hour and get to heaven someday. It goes beyond that, right? Check your box. Absolutely.
Yeah. And that's part of the role of pastoring, is discipling your people to learn how to, and to give them space to, quote unquote, open their fridges to one another. You know, and if we're not giving them that space and not modeling that and teaching that, then, you know, that might not happen.
Right. And so if we go back to Robert Long, right, and just thinking about his life and thinking about my own life, we're all conditioned to suppress and to hide our insecurities, our fears, our mistakes, the things that we're ashamed of, as opposed to, right, covenanting and doing this accountability with one another. So I think I said in the sermon something along the lines of, you know, Robert Long, he decided to do the terrible and horrible deeds that he did because he was afraid for his salvation or something like that. And so he was afraid of not being able to get to heaven because he was afraid of lust. Welcome to humanity, buddy, right? He was afraid of feelings. He was afraid of the other. And so when we keep that tight and not do that in community, it leads to this destruction. I mean, we do that with our own mental health. If I don't talk about my feelings with my spouse, if I don't talk about my feelings with my covenant group, if I don't share the things I'm struggling with, and I choose to do that alone, the only outlet is through, I think, destructive means, either harming myself or harming others. And I think, you know, that experience, that moment in you know, that we drew from in the sermon, the Robert Long, it's an expression of that. And we see that every day, not maybe to that extreme, but because Christian folk have been told that you got to be pure, you got to be clean, no mistakes, you know, wear your Sunday best, which, you know, I still wear a tie every Sunday. I'm not criticizing that, but this mentality of I can only bring, quote unquote, my best self to God and not my real self to God, that's what leads us to brokenness and harming behavior.
Yeah.
Yep.
We've been doing a lot of air quotes in this,
yes.
Well, in this conversation. Yet another air quote, Sunday quote best.
Sunday quote best. That's right.
Yeah, that's funny.
Well, Joe, there's so much still in this sermon. I think the best thing for people to do is listen to it. And as people listen to it, if they jot down questions or answers or things that come up for them to kind of share with us. But thank you for this gift of your words, of your passion, of your vulnerability. I mean, you really model that in this service. And so talk about teaching people, bringing your true self. You're such a good example of this. And so we appreciate the sermon. We appreciate the conversation today. We appreciate you. So thank you so much, my friend.
Absolutely. I'm a huge fan of the podcast, and I appreciate all the great work you're doing and the invitation to be on here and always to connect with friends. And so thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of the Collective Tables Sermon Podcast Hour. May you continue to encounter the mystery of a God ever present.
May you live into the grace that God has set before you.
May you remain open to the ever expansive love of our great God.
May you find joy and peace in the small and large moments.